Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, and I'm no longer going to be introducing you as the co-host, Rob. I'm just going to say you're another host. And our other host, Rob Moore, bringing us the news today.
But you are the ultimate host,
the
Lauren.
The ultimate host. Lamia teching for us
the
today.
Ultimate tech.
I was just sharing with Rob that I'm getting my wisdom teeth out tomorrow.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so I might not be here for next week. Like, I mean, eventually I'll come back.
Puffy cheeks.
No problemo.
Yeah. So I guess before we jump into the news, I'll give you a quick rundown on our interview today. We're going to be speaking with an associate professor at Lakehead University in the Faculty of Education. She's a past advisor of mine at the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University. Her name is Dr. Connie Russell, and we're going to be talking with her about ecotourism. She's done a lot of interesting research on whale watching and also worked with orangutans, and so I'm really excited to talk with her. And we're also going to talk about some more sort of academic questions around representation and voice. I think that a lot of animal activists, environmentalists, and other people doing activist work often are in a position where we're speaking on behalf of others, and she has some interesting ideas about how we can navigate that in an ethical and careful way. So I'm really excited to speak with Connie, so please stay tuned for that.
And I'll also send a big, huge shout-out to our good friend Neil Harvey in Guelph, who has updated our website and sort of reinvigorated it, I guess, for the 21st century. It's much more interactive now. People can go and actually make comments on the shows. They can use the comment section to ask questions for upcoming guests. And you can also sort by categories in the show. So if there's a particular topic that you're interested in, like direct action or law, you can find just one of those shows and then click on the categories. And then all the shows we've done that relate to that category automatically pop up.
And so, yeah, because it's kind of difficult when you're looking at an archive of over 100 shows.
Yeah, we've got like almost 150 shows.
Right. So let's say you were interested in, you know, farmed animal welfare or something like that. You could just type that in and then find all the shows that we've done on that topic. So it's really cool. Thank you so much, Neil. I hope to see some dialogue, too, between our listeners about the shows. Rob and I and Lamia and a small group of friends of ours, we always end up debating the shows a little bit and talking about things that we thought went wrong or things that we thought were particularly interesting. And if you have any feedback, that's a great way to see what other people are talking about as well by posting something on the website. But you can always write us as well. And give us your feedback about the show or ideas for upcoming programs. And our website is animalvoices@ciut.fm.
Or that's our email. And our website is www.animalvoices.ca. All right, on to the news. We've got a lot today. First, from the AP News, the Associated Press. Not long after disclosing that its French fries contain more trans fat than thought, McDonald's Corporation said Monday that wheat and dairy ingredients are used to flavor the popular menu item, an acknowledgement it had not previously made. McDonald's had said until recently that its fries were free of gluten and milk or wheat allergens and safe to eat for those with dietary issues related to the consumption of dairy items. But they quietly added, quote, contains wheat and milk ingredients, end quote, this month to the French fries listing on its website. The company said the move came in response to new rules by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for the packaged foods industry, including one requiring that the presence of common allergens such as milk, eggs, wheat, fish, or peanuts be reported. It's amazing that until a week ago, I think, that McDonald's was allowed to actually lie about its product ingredients. Makes you wonder what else they're not telling us. A great op-ed in the New York Times really hits home, I think, the point that anyone who buys a purebred dog or cat doesn't really care at all about giving a companion animal a home. They basically want a nice piece of furniture that looks good on a leash. The article says the 130th Westminster Dog Show came to New York with its thousands of contestants, ranging in size from 2-pound Chihuahuas to 120-pound Great Danes. In the case of dog shows, a given breed's parent club sets the standard for the breed's look or style. Unfortunately, in some breeds, form has trumped function. The Pekingese and the Bulldog, whose flattened faces make breeding difficult, are two examples. Such design flaws, often perpetuated by breeders trying to produce a dog with a unique look, have enduring consequences for individual dogs, their progeny, and the people who love them. Of the 180 breeds listed on one popular website for choosing purebred puppies, 42% have chronic health problems, skin diseases, stomach disorders, a high incidence of cancers, the inability to bear young without cesareans, and shortened lifespans. The list is as disturbing as it is long and poses a question. Dazzled by the uniqueness of many of the breeds we've created, have we, the dog-owning public, turned a blind eye to the development of a host of dysfunctional animals? If every dog buyer did such research, it would help shut down the 5,000 puppy mills that, according to the Humane Society, provide most of the 500,000 purebred dogs sold through pet stores and the Internet. Poorly regulated, unsanitary factories in which females are imprisoned their entire lives, puppy mills survive because people get charmed by that puppy in the window. Unlike the wrong computer or an automobile, however, faulty dogs can't be readily exchanged or resold. They can be given up to an animal shelter, and they are at the rate of about 4 million dogs each year, this soothing phrase disguising the end of 50% of them, a gas chamber or a lethal injection. We owe our dogs more than this. After all, it is we who have shaped them. Even when we err, they continue to put their trust and their lives in our hands. That great piece was written by Ted Carasotti, I think it's pronounced. Again, the New York Times. Next, from the Examiner Enterprise Online, meatpacking plants where horses are slaughtered for food were granted permission by the Agriculture Department on Tuesday to continue the practice despite protests from Congress and animal rights groups. A law passed last fall eliminated taxpayer funding for inspectors to work at the plants with the stated intent to close down the three facilities where the animals are processed. But in a decision that elicited threats of legal action by animal groups, the USDA granted a request by the plants to pay government-approved inspectors themselves. Each year, three meatpacking plants, two in Texas and one in Illinois, slaughter an estimated 90,000 horses and ship the meat overseas. Strange story. A friend of mine from Montreal recently actually told me that a nutritionist at his gym told him to increase his protein intake by eating horse meat. True story. Next, from NWA Online, chickens at Tyson Foods Incorporated's Dardanelle complex should not be left in company-owned freezers to die, according to the Humane Society of the United States. Peter Wood, the Humane Society's deputy manager for cruelty issues, wrote a letter to Tyson Foods that said a Tyson employee told the Humane Society the growers placed cull birds, those who are sick or not growing fast enough on farms, into large Tyson-owned freezers to die, a process that could take days. Tyson spokesman Gary Mickelson said the company has not previously heard claims about birds left to freeze to death. Contract chicken producers who grow birds on farms for Tyson also have freezers on their farms to store deceased birds for later shipment to a rendering plant. Tyson has 54 chicken plants company-wide and processes 2.21 billion birds per year. I'm sure you've all heard that Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, shot a fellow hunter on a quail hunting trip over the weekend. Yeah, it's true. And I like this irreverent piece from Slate.com. According to the Corpus Christi Caller-Times, which broke the story of Dick Cheney's hunting accident, 78-year-old lawyer Harry Whittington has no plans to sue the vice president for shooting him. "This happens, and my God, I've never seen a case of hard feelings," ranch owner and host Catherine Armstrong told reporters. I bet this would deepen their friendship. No wonder Brokeback Mountain is bombing in the heartland. Real men don't surprise each other by falling in love. A true friend accidentally shoots you in the face.
I've been laughing the whole time I've been reading that, Rob. It's so funny.
Gotta love Slate.com. Meanwhile, the Toronto Star says the White House is grappling with the fact that the U.S. public was not informed for 24 hours after its VP shot someone, and that it raises more questions about the convoluted information pipeline in and out of the White House. Cheney also drew criticism in 2003 from animal rights groups for shooting some 70 pheasants at an exclusive Pennsylvania club. And yet another stunning article by the excellent Matthew Scully in the National Post about the seal hunt.
Is that his formal title?
The excellent Matthew Scully. He is in my book. Forming right now inside their mothers, seal pups will soon fill the ice floes off Newfoundland and Labrador. Then comes one of their very first sights on this earth, the swarms of men bearing clubs, hooks, guns, and knives. Welcome to the world. Nature has its own ruthless ways, as those men like to remind us, and makes no special allowance for the young and helpless. But this annual killing binge is not of nature's design, and there has always been something uniquely abhorrent in the spectacle. If we could understand what possesses people to do such things, and do it all with such smug self-assurance, the insight would have relevance far beyond Atlantic Canada. There are professed reasons, the marginal economic benefits of the hunt, the protection of an ancient, quote, way of life, etc., have never really explained it. When you've dispensed with all their excuse-making, it becomes clear we are dealing here with some deep and implacable force. Cruelty is the endpoint of greed and other vices, and rarely done for its own sake. Yet in every age and every place, there is a certain type of man who glories in violence, only more when the victims are helpless and innocent. There is, quote, a cruelty that is fed, not weakened, by tears, end quote, as a long-ago philosopher observed. Whether this malevolence directs itself at humans or at animals, it all comes from the same rot, the same dark and unreachable place in the human heart. Recall, too, that all of this cruelty is subsidized, propped up by millions of dollars a year from Canada's taxpayers. Yet all arguments were lost last time around on Prime Minister Paul Martin. Even to the very end, he could be heard pandering in Atlantic Canada during last month's election with pledges to, quote, save the seal hunt. So let it be a Conservative government that finally brings the wretched business to an end. It would be a fitting start for Prime Minister Stephen Harper, a courageous and merciful exercise of his new powers. And to a watching world, no decision of his could more dramatically demonstrate that corrupt old ways will no longer be tolerated, and a new day has truly arrived in Ottawa. If Matthew Scully is listening, I want to thank him for continuing to publish articles like that in our National Post. It's much appreciated. And the world definitely is watching, finally, from Spiro News. Italy announced Monday that it has temporarily suspended imports of seal skins and seal-derived products. In addition, a legislative proposal to permanently prohibit all commerce in seal skins and seal-derived products also was introduced into the Italian Parliament. That proposal is supported by the government coalition and is designed to complement the existing import ban on cat and dog fur. Italy's fur industry makes it one of the most important markets for seal pelts in Europe. Italy is also an important gateway by which seal products are imported and then re-exported to other countries. Today's announcement illustrates the growing momentum in Europe to shut down the markets for seal products, said Leslie O'Donnell, director of IFAW's European office. The important legislative efforts in Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Mexico will contribute towards putting an end to the cruel and unjustifiable massacre of seals. We call on other European governments to follow these promising examples. The modern Canadian seal hunt is as big as it has been in 50 years. Over the last 3 years, 985,312 seal pups were killed on the ice off eastern Canada. Seal pups can be legally hunted at about 12 days old once they molt their white natal fur. More than 95% of these seals killed annually are less than 3 months old. The life expectancy of harp seals is about 30 years. And that's it for this week's news.
Thanks, Rob. I'm curious because you had mentioned two in your news article, well, probably more than that, but two major industries, the dog breeding industry and then the sealing industry. And it seems like, I mean, the approach to both of those perspectives was more like it's rooted in people's, there's something inherently cruel about people, or they're expressing some kind of cruelty. And I often go back to analysis around capitalism as being kind of a motivating force, and I've had a lot of people challenge me on that, and I do think it's more complicated, but I'm wondering, how do you make sense of the sealing industry and the dog breeding industry? Do you think it's really just people a disregard and not willing to look at animals in any kind of empathetic way, or do you think that there's other things going on?
I think it's a matter of it's almost the same reason why people eat meat. It's something that's taught out of us, I think, at a very young age. The sympathy is actually taught out of us. As little children, if we see seal pups, our instinct is not to kill them or to get a club and club them over the head or skin them alive, as we've heard in those reports. But we're taught by our elders who have made money or they've profited off of it or it's part of their culture that this is the way of life, this is what we have to do, this is what you have to deal with. So deal with it and get past it and let's continue to uphold this practice.
Yeah, because there was this documentary that recently came out about the sealing industry, and you know this person was talking about it really being rooted in tradition and you know an East Coast way of life. And it seems like when animal activists are trying to challenge that kind of massacre, as you put it, that there's so much weight of history behind challenging these huge practices.
It's true, and I mean, well, there's history in all of the, I think, the abhorrent practices that we've encountered, you know, in our civilization, you know, towards women, towards blacks, towards gays, but there's always been an evolution of thought, and I think, you know, animals are the next frontier of that kind of evolution.
Yeah, the tradition argument is always interesting when you think about, for me, when I think about meat, because the industrial practices that we see, you know, in the intensification of animal agribusiness are about like the, you know, they're at the antithesis of what traditional, so-called traditional hunting would have looked like. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Head.
So anyway, it's just, I just wanted to throw that out there as being, because I mean, I like Matthew Scully's perspective, but I always feel like he maybe, I don't know, I feel like he doesn't grapple with some of the complexities, but maybe that's the, Maybe that's what you have to do in a newspaper.
It's true. I mean, he's an important voice, though, I think, especially on the political landscape, since he's kind of part of the right wing, the Republican Party down in the States. I think he's a really great voice to have in this argument, whatever his perspective is, if it's more of a welfarist policy as opposed to a rights policy, that kind of thing. So I hope, if he's listening, please email me back. We kind of been playing email tags, so I'd love to have him on the show, so hopefully we'll get that for you sometime in the near future.
And I wonder too, you know, like I feel like for ourselves in doing media stuff, you know, on a much smaller scale than publishing in a national newspaper, but you're always kind of forced to make editorial choices and to grab people and spinning things in a particular way that you're going to be heard. And I feel like sometimes I'll stand in front of my students and I'll be like, you know, things are complicated, and they start glazing over. Mm. And so I wonder about, as activists, what kind of editorial choices we have to make in order to maintain that kind of punchiness that right. he has right so yeah. well in his writing.
Definitely,
so.
Yeah.
Anyway, some questions.
Some food for thought.
We're going to take a quick break, come back with Connie Russell, and we're going to be talking about ecotourism and representation. Some of those questions I was asking Rob will definitely feed into our conversation with Connie about how do we go about representing nature and animals, taking on their voices and saying who they are and what their interests are. So please stay tuned to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. We just heard from Rob Moore bringing us our weekly news digest. Now we're going to turn to an interview with Dr. Connie Russell. She is a professor, an associate professor at Lakehead University, and I'm really excited to speak with her today because I got to work with her in my master's, and she really really influenced my development as a scholar and an activist, so I feel very indebted to her, and it's a real honor to have her on the program today. We're going to speak about her research on ecotourism, as well as some of the recent work that she's done on representation and talking about how one goes about problematizing representations of nature and animals. So, Connie, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Well, Lauren, I'm delighted to be here, and it's great to talk to you because, in fact, I still cite your master's research.
Oh, good.
So helpful in terms of an example of looking at intersecting oppressions, in terms of looking at both animal welfare issues as well as, you know, human issues. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. So we get to have a dialogue on air, which is lots of fun.
Yes.
I was thinking, you know, it's funny. I was reading through an article that I guess is still fairly recent. It's called that you wrote called "Whoever Does Not Write Is Written: The Role of Nature in Post-Post Approaches to Environmental Education Research." And it's funny, you know, thinking about the name of the show, Animal Voices, that we're in a position all the time where we're you know, speaking on behalf of animals, or at least interviewing people who are speaking on behalf of animals. And sometimes we'll hear a dog barking in the background, or we'll hear a rooster crowing somewhere if we're interviewing somebody at a sanctuary. And that's always a very cool moment because sort of chance in some ways for the actual voices of animals to kind of come into play. And I wanted to talk with you about some of your work on representation, but I wanted to focus the beginning part of the interview on ecotourism. So I know that you've done work on whale watching, and also you've done other work with orangutans, for example. What were some of the driving questions or reasons why you pursued looking at ecotourism in your scholarship?
Well, it was sort of a circuitous route to the problem. I had been actually studying for my undergraduate thesis in psychology the orangutans at the Metro Toronto Zoo, and I was looking at like play behavior, and you know, it was a pretty lame study. But what I found so interesting was the ways in which the zoo visitors interacted with the orangutans in terms of throwing candies at them or, hey, you stupid monkey, and that sort of thing. And I didn't quite know what to do with that, except for I knew that I was really intrigued with it. So, you know, put that aside for a while, worked outside the academy. And when I came back to do my master's, I became increasingly interested in nature experience. And part of that came from my own experience growing up on a farm with, you know, a whole variety of animals. And moving to Toronto and finding, for example, when I lived in residence my first year, students, you know, we're all from urban areas primarily, and we're saying, oh, you know, where'd you grow up? It's like, oh, in Flesherton and on a farm. I'm like, oh, what did you do? It's like, we raised animals. And what did you do? Well, we killed them. And so my nickname in residence that year became Cow Killer, much to my chagrin. This was not how I envisioned myself. And it demonstrated to me just how disconnected people had been from their food in terms of, you know, because these were all meat eaters. This wasn't, you know, a critique based on any sort of informed, they were just like horrified that we would kill the animals, but they were still eating hamburgers and things. So it intrigued me in terms of our lack of experience with that on which we're dependent, and that could be on the vegetables we eat and all sorts of different things. It didn't have to mean eating animals, but so I just became intrigued by the fact that people seem to be disconnected from nature, and then became intrigued by the ways in which experiences with nature became commodified. So I became interested in ecotourism, that people would pay tons and tons of money to go and spend time in natural areas, observing wildlife, that sort of thing, spend lots and lots of money, sort of have a list of, oh, well, I saw the gorillas in Rwanda, and then I saw the lions in, you know, the Kalahari, and then I went and saw kangaroos in, you know, Australia or whatever, that it felt like an odd relationship that I wanted to explore further.
And so what do you think that's about, this this desire to make a list of animals that that people want to say that they've seen or to experience?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not quite sure about the listing phenomena. There's actually you know, a few people who've been looking at birders and trying to get an understanding of what that, you know, in terms of that need to commodify that sort of competition thing in terms of who's got the most most birds. And there's been some observations of some birders who, you know, once they've got the bird on their list, they're not actually spending a lot of time watching the bird and coming to know the bird in some way. You know, whereas I also know birders who, you know, that's just sort of a way of facilitating a relationship with birds and an excuse to get out and spend time with birds. So it isn't necessarily a commodified experience, but it can be. And then I think that, you know, for so many of us, we don't have daily interactions with other life. You know, there might be the squirrel that's running up your street. You know, depending on where you're living, you might have some. But I think there is an attraction for some folks for what's called charismatic megafauna. E.O. Wilson dubbed that term in terms of wanting connection with some of these, you know, big predators. In terms of, I think there is an attraction there, but it's become disnified in terms of, yeah, people have some bizarre understandings of what predators are and don't quite understand that we could be prey, for example. Mm. So I've got examples from my brother-in-law who works out at the zoo of people dipping their kids in, you know, the tiger pen because they dropped their hat or something and having no understanding that their kid would be quite tasty and that even that tiger in a pen is not a domesticated animal. It, you know, just not seeing that we ourselves are animals and part of, part, you know, could easily be part of a predator-prey relationship on the other end.
Is zoos then, are they part of what you would categorize as ecotourism, or ecotourism more, I think people envision, you know, going out into a boat and you're observing dolphins, or even, you know, people, you know, going and swimming with dolphins, or, you know, you're on safari, for example. Do zoos fit into that? Is it a different type of set of relationships that's engendered between zoos as versus, you know, those tours that we were talking about before?
I think it's more a matter of degree rather than kind. I think that lots of zoos would like to label themselves as a form of ecotourism because there's that sort of greenwashing phenomena that all sorts of folks want to call themselves ecotours because it's sort of sexy and cool and a way to market. Whereas scholars who are looking at ecotourism have, you know, there's a whole range of continuum that people use in terms of dependency on nature, natural areas, looking at sort of impacts on natural areas, local animals, involvement of local human communities, that sort of thing. And frankly, there's sort of this ideal notion of ecotourism that I don't know of any form that actually meets that ideal. So I just sort of see that there's a whole wide range of things. In terms of our relationships with other animals, I think that zoos, because animals are, you know, in cages or enclosures and the control thing is so obvious that the relationship's a little bit different. But I would argue that many safaris aren't a whole lot different in terms of these are animals who've been habituated to human presence. They're often in a fairly limited areas. There's been documentation of changes in behavior in a whole variety of species. So, you know, they're still wild animals, and there's a wildness there, but they're also becoming increasingly influenced by, you know, hordes of folks coming to look at them, and they've adapted to that and are living their lives in the context of that. But there still is an element of control going on and all sorts of things going on behind the scenes that the tourists don't see in terms of animals being shot if they're acting aggressively or, you know, if they're going outside the boundaries of what, you know, people in parks might think the animals should be doing.
Hmm. I imagine when people find out that you do stuff on ecotourism that they probably put you in a number of different camps which don't really represent what you do. Like, you're either promoting ecotourism because there's this notion, well, we're destroying the natural environment and the people who are destroying it shouldn't be destroying it anymore, you know, for logging. What we need to do is funnel them into ecotourism and then they won't destroy the environment anymore. There's sort of that side of it. And then I guess on the other side, you know, somebody may be believing that you are completely against ecotourism. And I remember a conversation that we had many years ago and you were saying, you know, there's still something in that desire for connection that's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough to say this is corrupt or something like that, that it's more complicated than that. How do you express your I'm sure, complicated position towards ecotourism involving animals?
Yeah, it is a tough one, in terms of, because, frankly, I see more evidence of problems than potential. But I also don't think it's going away anytime soon, and I think that it does reflect a desire for connection. And, you know, and it is amazing. I loved hanging out on the whale-watching boats and seeing the whales come up, break the surface. It really was magical and wonderful. So there is potential there, but it has to be better organized. People have to be much more aware of the various problems associated with it and not be in denial, because I think there's lots of folks who see ecotourism as a panacea for precisely the reasons you mentioned, in terms of it is or can be a more, I don't like the word sustainable, but a more sustainable way of you know, making a living in natural areas. So yeah, you know, I think that it has potential, but it's still problematic, and most people I know aren't open to the criticism. And you're seen as sort of a grumpy person who's just, you know, being a pain in the butt rather than asking questions that hopefully will improve practice so that the animals are less affected. There is an opportunity for some connection. There is an opportunity for education and perhaps you know, encouraging folks because of that moment to become more actively involved in conservation or animal welfare or whatever.
I want to talk about what that would look like, but we have to do a quick station ID, and then we'll come back more with Connie Russell from Lakehead University. Welcome back to Animal Voices. We're speaking with Associate Professor Connie Russell at the Faculty of Education, Lakehead University. I failed to mention at the beginning of the program that Connie is also a co-editor of the Canadian Journal of Environmental Education. So thanks, Connie, for being here today.
Great.
So before we had that very short break, you were talking about people not necessarily being open to critiques, but that these critiques could possibly lend themselves to, I think you put maybe in quotes, a sustainable or maybe better practice in some ways. Can you talk about some of the insights then that you've drawn from your research that you think could improve the industries in terms of ecotourism?
Yeah, I think that there's a variety of people working on ecotourism from a whole variety of disciplinary perspectives. So, you know, from economics to biology and just a range of different ways of looking at things. And some of the insights, I think, from my own research and others is, one, paying attention to the educational aspects of it in terms of I've been on a number of eco-tours where, you know, the education has consisted of, oh, there's a whale and it weighs, you know, 10 tons and eats this amount of krill in a day. And the tourists themselves were really dissatisfied with that sort of interpretation being offered, that they wanted a much more politicized form of education. They wanted to know what the threats were to the whales, for example, and what sorts of things they could do differently in their own lives to ensure that those whales could continue to live. So I think paying attention to education, but not just relaying of facts, but sharing of stories, talking explicitly about threats and possible forms of activism in response to those threats is really important. I think also paying attention to the animals themselves. And I was recently involved with a symposium with the International Primatological Society where a colleague, a primatologist, and I co-organized this symposium and brought people from a whole range of disciplines and focused on a whole range of different primates, looking at some of the problems associated with it. So, for example, disease transmission. Primates, non-human primates, are quite similar to us, and so can catch all sorts of diseases that we've got, and vice versa. And there's been lots of examples of, you know, for example, the gorillas, the mountain gorillas, catching human diseases, and then that floating through their particular population. There's all sorts of examples of human communities being shoved out of parks or being not benefiting in any way economically from ecotourist ventures, so that people who are making the money are, you know, international companies, airlines, international companies that own hotels, that sort of thing. So there's a real problem with economic leakage. So paying attention to those variety of factors in terms of how to involve locals, that these projects are locally controlled and owned, how to ensure that the animals themselves are not being harmed, that in fact ecotourism does more harm than good. You know, because the notion is that, you know, if tourists are more educated, they'll become more committed and contribute to conservation, but there isn't a lot of evidence that that happens. There's also the notion that tourists contribute lots of money to these communities, and therefore the animals become worth something alive rather than dead. And again, because of economic leakage, there isn't a lot of evidence of that. So we need to pay attention to a whole range of things. And so there's examples of locally controlled projects that are really good in terms of economic leakage issues, but maybe not so great on the animal treatment of animals issue, or perhaps not so good on the educational end. So that, you know, it's complicated and we need to be paying attention to all those factors. And that's why I think what was happening with the symposium was really interesting in terms of bringing together a whole range of different folks who were identifying a series of problems, but also examples of ways in which some of those problems were being handled well, so that we had an interdisciplinary, complicated response to the problems of ecotourism without dismissing it altogether. Although there are certain sites where there probably should not be ecotourism at all, and that we need to get better at naming those as well, where the populations are so fragile or the cost to the animals are so great that it isn't worth it and we have no business being there.
Do you find that when you're trying to offer an alternative perspective and you're dealing with large corporations that have, you know, quite a bit of financial investment in these projects, that they'll spin it as, if you're being critical of ecotourism, that you're saying you want the local people to, you know, not have jobs, or that you're somehow against having some kind of livelihood? It seems like part of the uncomfortability of ecotourism is that so many multinational, larger forces have been responsible for taking away people's ability to sustain themselves in different ways, and then ecotourism has kind of slid in as this is what you can do now. How do you navigate some of those tensions?
Yeah, that is really difficult, right? And that's why it intersects so well with, you know, issues around international development and you know, local control over what's going on. And yeah, there's always been that argument that it's like, oh, well, you know, some jobs are better than no jobs, and, you know, sort of that, you know, oh, well, we'll take care of the locals. And so, yeah, that critique is hard to hear for some folks. But I think it's important to continue raising those issues. And, again, I just haven't seen lots of evidence of locals making, having much control over what's going on. So that, you know, they might be working in a local hotel or working as a local guide, but the money they're making comparatively can be substantially less than what, you know, the Westerners who are involved are making. It depends, of course. You know, when I'm thinking about whale watching in Quebec, where I did my work, you know, Tadoussac is, you know, booming because of whale watching, and that is what sustains the town, and lots of townsfolk are involved in the process, you know, whether they're running hotels or bed and breakfasts or camps, or they've got boats that are going out in the water. And that's an example of where a small town has pretty much control that, you know, there's some corporations involved, but there's also small businesses, you know, where one person may just have one or two boats that they take out. And the community has been working together well in terms of trying to develop community-based guidelines to ensure that the whales themselves aren't being harmed by whale watching, and they're working in collaboration with the biologists in town who are doing research on the impacts of whale watching on whales, for example, and as a group have agreed to certain guidelines. So there are examples of locals being involved. It gets more complicated when you're talking about countries that, you know, have had a history of colonialism and impoverishment and that sort of thing, you know, then you have to be looking at sort of the histories of colonialism and the racism that's going on and that sort of thing as well, which makes it much more complicated.
I'm thinking about some of the insights from feminist theory around the need for situated knowledges, and that it's really difficult to make generalizations about what this means, because it's going to be different depending on the context and the history and all these other factors that are going to converge. Yeah, I'm glad that you touched on the issue of colonialism, which is something I'd like to explore a little bit more. I know that ecotourism has been heavily criticized as being a form of neo-colonialism, mm-hmm. and I think that people often think about that in terms of people and what that means in terms of, you know, going and looking at people doing some kind of ritual that we've deemed, people in the West have deemed as being, you know, indigenous to that area, and then we get to kind of consume it through our ecotourism, and they become part of the spectacle in that way. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that animals also figure into that, you know, being able to gain unlimited access and wanting that unlimited access and being able to add it to your roster in some way. I know that you said and you've indicated, you know, through interviews you've done with people that people are genuinely often interested in wanting to know more than kind of a surface level. But there does seem to be an element potentially around commodification and colonialism. Can you comment on that at all?
Oh, absolutely. In terms of, people's expectations of what's going to happen and then the bitchiness that occurs if expectations aren't met. I remember one time in Tadoussac being on a boat with a French immersion school trip, and there were a group of young people who were complaining that they hadn't seen the whales giving birth in the three-hour trip. And I'm like, okay, that's pretty bizarre. So talk to them a little bit more about it. And, you know, part of it was just them watching Discovery Channel all the time and thinking that, you know, you just sort of go out there and these, you know, they're going to be seeing all these amazing spectacles. with not realizing that, you know, a 30-minute documentary probably took 3 years of shooting to get that. But that's part of, you know, what they're seeing on television and through the media, all these amazing things, is that there is a disappointment. The whales in Tadoussac often don't show their tails. They're species that don't fluke. And that was a problem for some tourists because they wanted to see the whales flying out of the water. You know, they had notions of what humpback whales did and, you know, didn't realize that fins and minkes didn't often do that. And so that happens with a variety of species where people, that they've got this notion of how the animals ought to behave and that it ought to be easy for them to see these animals doing, you know, a whole variety of things. And that's just not the case. That's not reflecting the reality of the animals' lives, nor is it respecting the reality of the animals' lives or respecting privacy. It's like, why, you know, should I expect to be able to see a whale giving birth? Or why should I be watching animals having sex, for example? You know, so there's a real voyeurism going on sometimes in terms of wanting to see animals doing various things.
It just becomes TV, I think, on some level.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, and I remember on the whale-watching boats watching some folks who, you know, they're literally sort of sitting back in the Zodiac with their feet up on the side of the boat with their arms crossed, and they were looking like they were watching television. You know, it's like, how could you not be, like, jumping up and going, ooh, ah, or wanting to feel the water on your face or whatever. So, yeah, for some folks it's very passive and, yeah, expecting sort of like old colonial times. Yeah, just haul me out to see that animal and I'll look at it. And, you know, perhaps I'm not going to shoot it with my gun anymore. I may just shoot it with a camera. But, you know, again, sort of expecting sort of locals to, you know, take you out on these safaris and get these amazing opportunities and pictures and then away you go. And, you know, people don't usually spend enough time to develop any sort of relationship, nor could they. Nor would we want them, you know, a whole whack of people to be hanging out there for weeks at a time. But, you know, what do you learn about another animal from, you know, watching her or him for 2 hours?
Yeah, and all those, I mean, those expectations, it seems, about, you know, performance of behavior, but also expectation, cultural expectations about what is a whale, what constitutes whaleness. And then how, I wonder, I mean, this gets into the second portion of what I wanted to talk about today. How can those assumptions, if they need to be challenged, or in your opinion, if they need to be challenged, how would interruptions happen? How do we get maybe people to unpack some of those assumptions? I don't know if that's possible on a boat that's doing whale watching, or how do we presume that we're not just inserting a whole other set of assumptions? You know, that's not who the whale is. This is who the whale is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's always going to be the case, right? We're always constructing those other animals, and there's no way of ever knowing the true animal. So part of it is just sort of giving up that notion that we would ever, that every anything would be ever anything but a representation. But I think that, you know, interpretation in terms of the education offered on these trips can question things. Stories can be told that disrupt sort of the Discovery Channel version of what's going on with those animal lives. So that you can ask good questions and engage in interesting discussions about what's going on. And quite frankly, what I'm delighted by is when the animals themselves disrupt things. Like, you know, a whale may blow and it just, you know, whenever they're exhaling. And it's really stinky, fishy smell, right? And so people are experiencing it with their whole bodies, like, oh, I wasn't really thinking about that. Yeah, they eat fish and they sort of smell funny. Or, you know, whenever a chimp will throw shit at somebody. Or, you know, there's just ways in which the animals themselves do engage and surprise. Whenever I was in Tadoussac, you know, there's this group of sort of male belugas who were adolescents, so not with their maternal group anymore. And they would just, like, beetle up and down the river, you know, and they would chase boats. They would come up to boats and, you know, like to sit behind the rudder because perhaps it felt good. We're not quite sure what that was about. So that they themselves were actively involved and sometimes seeking out that connection because they were also curious about who we are and what we were doing out there. So that those moments to me were really helpful in terms of allowing agency of the animals themselves, and sometimes disrupting what the expectations of the tourists in terms of who these animals were, or that they were just there as spectacle, that they were just performing for us, that, you know, perhaps they did have lives of their own and personalities of their own and a sense of humor or whatever in terms of that was going on.
You use the term agency, and I'm wondering if you can tell us what that means to you. I know that you sort of you talked about it in context now, but why is that such an important idea for you?
Well, I guess for me, I want it's in some ways resistant to the earlier writing on the social construction of nature, which because it was earlier writing and just starting to probe at these ideas, getting at the notion that humans construct it all, that, for example, I would see trees as timber or home for birds or whatever, that I could construct trees in a variety of ways. And then other folks respond, it's like, well, it isn't just a one-way dynamic, that other animals and other life are also interacting with us, and that they themselves are part of the conversation. It isn't a one-way construction, so that, you know, I may go to Borneo with particular notions of what an orangutan might be like, but then I interact with that orangutan changes my notion because of my interactions with her or him. So I think it's important to acknowledge that it isn't all one way, that various animals are constructing us in terms of they've got particular notions. Mm-hmm. You know, my cat certainly thought that there was something wrong with me and my inability to catch mice, I think. So that, you know, there's also that they are constructing us and that they are part, you know, that it's not just one way, that we can't construct them in any old way that we want, that they are involved if we allow them to be involved and more experience with other animals, you know, you get more of a sense of who they are and that they do and that they're active in this construction.
You said that you know, you go to Borneo and your maybe your expectations, your assumptions, your constructions about animals are going to change. You know, an orangutan is not necessarily who you thought he or she was. What were some of the things that you learned that challenged you personally?
Well, they turned out to be a little scarier than I thought they would be.
Okay.
In terms of that, they were much stronger than I anticipated. And also what I found so interesting was that they interacted differently with other people, and I should know that by now in terms of, you know, my experiences with other animals. But I'm thinking of when I went there, I met an orangutan who was an ex-captive, so it had contact with humans and so had been habituated to humans. And her name was Thiswi, and she was really interested in my Teva sandals and so really liked to, you know, play with the, what's it called? Oh, I've gone
the strap
like,
or the Velcro or something?
Yeah, the Velcro. Okay. Yeah, she thought the Velcro was pretty neat. So I thought, you know, we'd spent a fair bit of time together. I thought she was, you know, that we had a little bit of a relationship because, you know, we'd spent a couple weeks together. And then my ex-husband arrived, I guess a month later. And I'm like, oh, you know, I really want you to meet Thiswi. She's this really interesting orangutan. And so we go out into the forest looking for her, and we find her. And she just was enamored by John. Mm-hmm. You know, it sort of shoved me out of the way, grabbed his hand, was walking down the path with him. Like, I was so not interesting at that point. You know, and so if I had only had my encounter with Thiswi based on my own, I'd have a particular picture of who she was. And then watching her with another human who she interacted with quite differently, and, you know, I think there was a sexual thing going on. She was quite, you know, another being. It was another side of her that I didn't see, right? And again, making her more complicated in the way that all of my human friends are complicated beings, you know? So having that wonderful opportunity to get to know another creature and see their sort of complicated nature, the fact that, you know, they don't operate the same way with everybody, nor with me the same way every time they see me either.
So you come back from doing this type of research, and then you're forced to kind of translate it all into academic work, and you're publishing, and you're going to conferences and stuff, and you know you're not really able to capture, you know, those moments exactly, and those feelings, or the wash of spray, you know, up from a blowhole or something like that. How do you go about representing animals, and I guess more generally representing nature in a way that you feel is respectful, takes in into account issues of agency, for example? How do we do that? I mean, on the show all the time, people talk about, and in animal rights discourses in particular that I've looked at, a lot of people talk about being the voice of the voiceless, for example, or we need to be their voice, or we need to speak for those who can't, and there's that kind of whole, this real urgency around representation, and that our representations are perhaps more right or more accurate. How do you approach those questions when you come to be in a position where you have to represent these others?
Yeah, well, so far I haven't done it well. It's something that I'm really starting to grapple with now. You know, my past writing on ecotourism has been very much just written from a human perspective, and the animals are sort of there, but not in any meaningful way. And I think what started me thinking about it was one of my students, who is a member of a Northern Cree community in Northern Quebec, and for her master's she was doing research on parental involvement in schools. And she said, you know, I'm really struggling with traditional theses because it doesn't allow me to capture my oral culture or respect my oral culture. And so what she did was used a CD so that she could actually literally have the voices of the members of her community in the dissertation itself. So it wasn't just all her perspective, and at least orally, there could be something else. It wasn't just text. And I found that really intriguing. I thought, yeah, you know, we need to think more about that in terms of, as you said, representing nature or other animals. And I'm not quite sure how to do it. In the paper I wrote recently, you know, it's like I'm thinking there are some possibilities with some of the new technologies, and there is more openness in academic writing now to alternate forms of representation, and that one of my colleagues has written, instead of typical sort of paragraph-formed, you know, English writing, using sort of epic poetry that better reflected his oral culture and the presence of other creatures and other life, you know, just percolated throughout the writing. I think that we could use sound. Not quite sure how we'd use smell at that point. You know, and it's funny because I'm not remotely technologically skilled. I've actually been a bit of a technophobe, but I think there's some real possibilities there in terms of having those disruptions. In my paper I wrote, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to, you know, throw out your paper and all of a sudden there's squawk in the middle of your paper to just remind you that, you know, these are real individuals and creatures that we're talking about. And yeah, and I think we have to keep trying to represent what some say are the voiceless, because I think, you know, to not do so is irresponsible. But I'm intrigued by how we might do so in more creative ways that better get at, you know, that allow their presence to be more fully felt.
I love this. You had so many great phrases that you brought in, both your own and from other people in that paper that I mentioned at the beginning of the program called Whoever Does Not Write Is Written, The Role of Nature in Post-Post Approaches to Environmental Education Research. And you quote here Arm Brewster, who's critical of what she calls the retreat response in the face of all these complications with representation. You can never really do it fully, and you're probably going to get it wrong, but that's not to say that we shouldn't try.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly it. I think we have to try, and yes, we'll make mistakes, but to just give up and not do so. And, you know, I love the way we keep feeding different ideas into things and that these conversations do help. And I've seen such a shift, you know, just even in terms of what academic theses look like now, which is really exciting, that people are, you know, they've got poetry, they've got images, they've got other things, and I think that those of us who are working in human-animal relations can learn from what's happening in other communities that are looking about how we represent those who may be oppressed in various ways.
I was going to ask you a really unfair question about what insights you think that post-structuralism can offer to some of these debates. But I know that we only have, you know, 1 minute left, so it's kind of a huge question. So I'm going to direct people to this article that you wrote, because I was very compelled by your description of post-post.
I hadn't come across
that yet. But I know we only have a minute or so left, but I wanted you to quickly comment, if possible, on the role of anthropomorphism and whether you see people taking on or talking about animals from a human-centered perspective. People are often accused in terms of human-animal relations that if we talk from a human perspective, that that's really awful, and we need to have a more scientific, objective approach, and that's the way to get at their real voices. Tell us about anthropomorphism and the role that you see in representing animals.
Right. Well, I think we can't be anything but anthropomorphic. We're humans, right? And I remember John Livingston saying, well, you know, my dogs are caninomorphic in terms of, you know, they're interpreting the world through their lens of being dogs. So that I think that, one, we have to constantly acknowledge, you know, our perspectives and how we're situated, right? And that we are human. So there's limits to how we can represent things. And once that's acknowledged, continue to keep trying, and that there's multiple perspectives out there, and that more and more of us have to be participating in these conversations, offering a whole variety of perspectives, and perhaps through those conversations, the life of other animals can be improved, you know, whether wild or domestic or whatever, that we all need to be participating in those conversations, acknowledging our various identities and how that influences our interpretation, but then not being paralyzed by that, but instead just acknowledging it and getting on with it.
And leaving room for those different ways, I guess, that the nature and animals speak back to us.
Yeah, exactly.
Connie, thank you for the great conversation. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the program today.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure too, Lauren, and it is great to have a conversation with you. We'll have to have a private one sometime,
yes.
too.
Thanks a lot, Connie.
Great. Thanks, Lauren.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. We are speaking with the Associate Professor Dr. Connie Russell. She's with the Faculty of Education at the University of Lakehead University. And this program will be archived shortly on our website, animalvoices.ca. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.